You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, standing shoulder to shoulder as Obama touches down in Tel Aviv, we examine America's pledge of support to Israel.
As I begin my second term as president, Israel is the first stop on my first foreign trip. This is no accident.
Also ahead, is South Korea under cyber attack? We talked to our Seoul correspondent about the computer outages at the country's banks and broadcasters.
Shinhan Bank said its customers were unable to access their online accounts, use mobile phones. There were reports about ATMs not working.
We'll also sneak between the pages of the culture section of Monocle magazine to ask Robert Bound what makes the Rijksmuseum so special. And guten Abend, herzlich willkommen. We examine the flourishing of Swiss German. All that, plus we'll look at this year's long list for the Orwell Prize, and we'll play some good music too. That's all to come here in the next hour on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
The president of the Cyprus Chamber of Commerce, Philidis, has today urged political leaders to find a solution to the current impasse for the survival of the island country, saying foreign investors were anxious and waiting to see what would happen.
Nightmare scenario, of course, and that's something I don't want to think about. If it does, then we're going to be picking up the pieces and see how we go forward. But I mean, that would really be the most disastrous of the scenarios that we have in front of us. We urge all political powers to work together. This is not a question of party politics. This is not a question even of politics. It's a question of survival of a nation.
His comments came as ministers arrived for an emergency cabinet meeting as the government sought solutions to avert a financial meltdown after the island's parliament rejected the terms of a bailout from the European Union, raising the risk of default and a bank crash. President Obama has arrived in Israel at the start of his first ever trip to the country. During his three-day visit, he'll hold talks with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. He's just been greeted by the Israeli President Shimon Peres at his residence in Jerusalem. The president said America's commitment to Israel's security was unwavering.
Across this region, the winds of change bring both promise and peril. So I see this visit as an opportunity to reaffirm the unbreakable bond between our nations, to restate America's unwavering commitment to Israel's security, and to speak directly to the people of Israel and to your neighbors.
Just as Obama arrived, over 100 demonstrators erected four large steel-framed tents and a massive Palestinian flag on Israeli-occupied land near Jerusalem. Palestinian activists set up a protest camp close to where Israel wants to build a new settlement, drawing attention to their struggle for land. Mustafa Barghouti is a senior Palestinian politician.
We're here to rebuild the village that the Israel is destroyed on our land. We're here to send a message to President Obama. Our struggle, our non-violent, peaceful resistance will continue till we are free. It is his duty to tell the Israelis enough is enough, and double standard is unacceptable. Settlements have to be removed, and Palestinian freedom has to be achieved.
Nearly two dozen West and Central African nations have pledged today to combat the growing threat of piracy and maritime crime in their coastal waters. The two regions border the oil-rich Gulf of Guinea, which is threatening to overtake the waters off Somalia as the world's most dangerous seas for piracy. Maritime attacks have become increasingly violent as criminal gangs exploiting governments' inability to police their coastlines venture further afield from their traditional home waters off Nigeria. Here, the British Finance Minister George Osborne has delivered the country's annual budget statement today, peppered with catcalls from opposition politicians as he announced a halving of this year's growth forecast.
This is a budget for people who aspire to work hard and get on. It's a budget for people who realise There are no easy answers to problems built up over many years. Just the painstaking work of putting right what went so badly wrong. And together with the British people, we are slowly but surely fixing our country's economic problems. We've now cut the deficit, not by a quarter, but by a third. We've helped business create not a million new jobs, but 1.25 million new jobs.
And finally, staying here, London's famous Victoria and Albert Museum has cancelled an experimental concert by the extreme metal band Napalm Death, fearing the noise level could damage the 104-year-old building. Ceramic artist Keith Harrison from the V&A was going to collaborate with the group, but it was feared the sculptural sound system would also disintegrate under decibel stress. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. The time has just gone 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, witnesses to the events on the tarmac at Tel Aviv Airport earlier on Wednesday were treated to quite an astonishing sight. Barack Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu almost falling over themselves to be nice to each other. The deeds were matched by words too. The Israeli Prime Minister described the US President's generosity for his visit, and Obama had this message in return.
The United States is proud to stand with you as your strongest ally and your greatest friend. As I begin my second term as president, Israel is the first stop on my first foreign trip. This is no accident. Across this region, the winds of change bring both promise and peril. So I see this visit as an opportunity to reaffirm the unbreakable bond between our nations, to restate America's unwavering commitment to Israel's security, and to speak directly to the people of Israel and to your neighbors.
A big statement there, not only cementing the US's love of Israel, but also recognizing the shifting political sands of the region. The visit, unsurprisingly, however, has been punctuated by its fair share of protest. Joseph Dana is our man in Jerusalem, on his way to one of the protests, I understand, and he joins us on the line now. Welcome to the programme, Joseph. Before we move to what's been happening on the Palestinian side of things, this greeting and moment on the tarmac between Obama and Netanyahu has been really quite astonishing, hasn't it, given the very public warmth between two men who ostensibly don't like each other one bit?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was not short on kind of pomp and pageantry, as it were. I mean, you know, Obama kind of landed into Ben-Gurion Airport, you know, amidst a kind of sea of Black Hawk helicopters, and this real demonstration of America's kind of power in the region. And he delivered a very, very warm speech to the Israeli public, kind of, you know, I would say going back on some of his comments that he made in Cairo a number of years back. And so Naftali Bennett, for example, one of the more right-wing leaders of the new Israeli government, said that this was one of the warmest speeches that any American president has ever given in Israel. And so I think the Israeli public was very even taken aback at the amount of warmth that was kind of demonstrated by Obama in his very first words upon landing in Israel.
Indeed. And I think one expression that really struck me was Obama saying our alliance is eternal. It's a marriage between them. There have been very low expectations, however, on what might be achieved during this visit. It's being billed as preliminarily a listening exercise by Obama.
Right, exactly. I mean, as Obama was giving these incredibly warm words to the Israeli public, I was actually watching the speech in Ramallah in a cafe, kind of in a haze of smoke, as it were, which is very typical for many of these cafes. And the expectations among the Palestinians were kind of
the exact opposite of what we were seeing by, you know, in the kind of Israeli discussion about the visit. And, you know, it's just they're not expecting Obama to actually bring any sort of message that will kind of shake the status quo of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict at this time.
Both Obama and Netanyahu have been locked away all afternoon having discussions. What do we know is on the agenda? I think Iran and Syria are on the top, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. Iran and Syria have definitely topped the agenda, as well as, you know, Israel's continued kind of military dominance in the region. I mean, Obama, after he gave these very warm remarks, went and viewed one of the Israeli Iron Dome batteries in a kind of display, almost a message, if you will, to the American Congress that Israeli military aid is a very, very important thing that should not be necessarily touched in a time of great financial trouble in the United States. But we saw a number of statements coming out from the Israeli media sphere this afternoon, kind of bringing the Syrian issue very much to the front. I mean, Israeli military analyst actually said that they believe that rebels were using some sort of chemical weapons recently, which is what the Russians and the Syrian state TV has been saying. And so we see that this is definitely trying to kind of set the agenda, or at least kind of tinge the agenda towards the Syrian issue that's happening in the north.
Let's move on to where you are at the moment. You are heading to protests which have been reasonably widespread since Obama's arrival, haven't they?
Well, I wouldn't say, yes, they've been reasonably widespread, but they've been very kind of savvy, if I can use that term, in Hebron, in the southern city of Hebron, which is really one of the most intense areas of the kind of Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a place where you can really feel it. A number of Palestinians actually wore Martin Luther King and Barack Obama masks walking down one of the very contentious streets in the neighborhood. They were quickly kind of arrested by Israeli security forces and kind of, you know, whisked away. And now I'm on my way to a village that's called Bab el-Shams, which is in the E1 corridor outside of Jerusalem. And if you remember, we discussed that the new Israeli government has talked about possibly building settlements in this very, very contentious slice of land outside of Jerusalem. And so the Palestinians have gone back and built a new kind of neighborhood there in a very, very clear signal that they want to put the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and specifically Israeli settlement building, on the agenda, or at least on the international media radar.
Now, in any other situation, any kind of protest on E1 would probably be met with some fairly non-negotiable attitudes from the Israelis. Is there any reluctance by the Israeli authorities at the moment to use any kind of force against any protesters, given the fact that Obama's in town?
Well, that is exactly the question that a lot of Palestinians are asking themselves at this moment. I mean, it's a very clearly provocative kind of step for the Palestinian protesters to rebuild this village. And right now, we have heard, at least we're getting reports, that the Israeli military has declared the area a closed military zone, which is normally what they do before they kind of go in and remove everyone. And so this evening should be very, very interesting in terms of how much force they would use in removing this village, or maybe they'll just leave it there until Obama leaves. You know, I mean, Obama is not going to be in Israel and Palestine for very long, and so maybe they have decided that, you know, the next 48 hours isn't going to hurt anyone, and then they'll remove the kind of village as soon as he takes off to Jordan. But it's going to be a very interesting evening just on the outskirts of Jerusalem.
You mentioned that you've been in cafes listening to the reaction to Obama's visit. What is the general consensus by the Palestinians about how much could be achieved by this meeting?
Well, the general consensus is a kind of demonstration of disillusionment with the American-led peace process. Palestinians were incredibly hopeful, and they always expressed to me how hopeful they were when Obama was elected in his first term. They really believed that his rhetoric about stopping Israeli settlement building and pushing the Israeli-Palestinian peace process forward had something of substance. And they have become completely disillusioned. And, you know, the remarks, the incredibly warm remarks that Obama made upon arrival in Tel Aviv without even mentioning the peace process and without even mentioning the Palestinian issue has really kind of contributed to that sense of disillusionment. And that's exactly what I've been hearing all afternoon, really.
In fact, I understand we have an interview with someone who you were speaking to today.
Bassam Zakari. I didn't care about the visit of Obama to Israel or to Palestine, because I know that Obama with Israel, he didn't support the peace process, he didn't support the Palestinian demands. So I didn't care about it. He want to visit Israel to support Netanyahu, to support Israel, because his party asked him to do this. Obama said that he want to visit Israel to support Israel and as a tourism. He didn't do anything because he his leader continued 4 years before and he didn't do anything. And he promised and said many things and didn't do anything on the ground. So we hope that Obama make a pressure for Israel, do something for the prisoners, to stop the settlements, to make the peace process continue for a period. We know the date of end of this negotiation, because we hope that the peace process continue well. But I suppose that America and Obama is with Israel, not with the peace process.
Fairly dismissive attitude there from a Palestinian voice there. Monocle's Joseph Dana in Jerusalem en route to Bab al-Shams. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. Coming up, South Korea's broadcasters and banks have been targeted in a cyber attack. We get the latest.
Change is in the air in Madrid, so Monocle Films headed to Spain to witness how small businesses are reassessing archaic practices in order to weather the storm.
We're selling a lot, and that's great. And that's because we have created a special experience of buying. We're very proud of being Spaniards, and that's something that we want to show off, because we think that there is a lot of people doing very interesting.
Madrid Remake, creatively minded Spaniards taking their fate into their own hands. Now playing on Monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House, where the time has just now nudged 17 minutes past the hour. South Korea is busy investigating a cyber attack that temporarily shut down central computer systems at some of the country's largest banks and broadcasters earlier on Wednesday. Companies that were attacked included Shinhan Bank, Nongkyup Bank, Munhwa Broadcasting Corporation, YTN and Korea's Broadcasting System 2. A cyber crisis headquarters was created soon after the attacks to investigate whether North Korea is behind these outages. This has already been widely assumed, as the attacks came amid an increase in friction over North Korea's nuclear weapons program. To give us the latest, Monocle's Korea correspondent Jason Strother spoke to our news editor Tom Edwards.
Just to remind us about what's happened today then, it seems a pretty serious, concerted attempt to sort of destabilize a number of pretty important institutions in the South.
Absolutely, Tom. It was mid-afternoon here when these the banks you mentioned, as well as the broadcasters, reported to the police agency that their computer networks had shut down. The broadcasters were still sending out their programs, but their internal networking was down. Shinhan Bank said its customers were unable to access their online accounts, use mobile phones. There were reports about ATMs not working. So it was pretty widespread. There have been, cyber attacks here before. Systems have been shut down. But in my memory, not this widespread where so many different institutions were affected. And Tom, as you said, there's the investigators here are still trying to figure out who was behind it.
So tell me, we've got this sort of cyber crisis headquarters to look into this. What do you think they're expecting to find? It's obviously difficult to sort of preempt their investigations, but such a widespread attack across a number of different companies all at once, it's pretty unusual. Are they fearing the worst immediately?
Well, of course, there's always the suspicion that North Korea is behind anything that goes wrong here in South Korea. But so far, the latest that I've been seeing is that there is so far no evidence that these attacks came from outside of South Korea. So there's no clear evidence that Pyongyang is behind it. But previous attacks that have happened over the past several years to government agency websites, other banks, and newspapers, North Korea has been reportedly behind that after months of investigations, the IP addresses were were able to be traced back to the north, where the South Korean government says an elite team of cyber hackers are working for the government to disturb both South Korean and U.S. Institutions.
And Jason, what's the kind of prevailing atmosphere in Seoul and more broadly throughout the country? Because you imagine, are a lot of these big corporations, do they generally work in a kind of area of paranoia about this kind of thing? Or are they generally a bit more robust about it? And how do, for example, you know, the markets respond when there's a kind of a breach of this type?
Okay, first with the markets, whenever North Korea makes the news, like when Kim Jong-il died, when there was the bombing of Yongpyeong Island back in 2010, the markets do react. There's usually a spike downward, but they recover pretty quickly. As for the institutions, you know, normally South Koreans don't pay very much attention to North Korea. But I think something like this, where consumers, where your average, you know, person on the street was affected, not able to use their banking systems, you know, at Shinhan or other mobile technology, banking technology, then it becomes a little bit more real. So I think if it does turn out that North Korea was in fact behind it, then at least the people who were affected might start taking the threat from the North a bit more seriously, because otherwise South Koreans and businesses are fairly apathetic to what happens above the border.
And just briefly, Jason, in terms of the kind of technological fallout of this, disregarding the North's possible involvement or otherwise, what's it generally like, you know, within Seoul, in South Korea, particularly, as you said, with that consumer focus? Is hacking a problem that occurs quite often? Are people very sensitive about it? It's obviously quite a tech savvy. There's a lot of tech literacy there. Are people kind of very aware of hacking and the risk it throws up in their day-to-day lives?
Well, Tom, that's a good question. South Korea does not have a hacking culture. There aren't, you know, bands of angry teenagers trying to take down, you know, the Korean Exchange Bank or hack into government databases like we see in the West. That doesn't really exist here. There is a lot of online security. I mean, all banks, like, just to get onto my bank online system, it requires quite a few loops to jump through, and God forbid if you have a Mac, then you're really out of luck with a lot of systems. But people, I've heard complaints from observers that Korea's security system, even though there are a lot, every website, home shop, online shopping site has a lot of security, that it's not as foolproof as you think, and it's not up to pace with the kind of hacking that goes on overseas, where their software could be easily manipulated and find a lot of holes through. So based on South Korean standards, the security might be enough, but when dealing with hackers from abroad, the concern is there that the system really isn't as foolproof as the agencies say they are.
Jason Strother in Seoul there, talking to Monocle's Tom Edwards. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, the port of Thessaloniki, Greece's second city, plays host to one of Europe's most exciting documentary film festivals. This year, the festival, which runs until March the 24th, will show nearly 200 films, about a third of them Greek, as well as events including roundtables, workshops and pitching forums. And as Monocle contributor Daniela Peled found out, the latest crop of Greek documentaries have something important to say about the country's current economic turmoil.
I started dancing just for fun, but now it's so much more than that.
People don't realize how hard it is to make it as a dancer.
The Thessaloniki Documentary Festival brings together an eclectic mix of films, opening with the award-winning First Position about young ballet dancers. Other offerings include Back to the Square, a portrait of post-Arab Spring Egypt, Gaia Girls, about Japanese female wrestlers, and Camino Musical, following musicians from Santiago de Compostela. But an emerging message in the nearly 60 Greek productions being shown during the festival is clear. Profound social change is happening in this society.
My name is Giordina Serpieri, and I work for the Greek department here in the Thessaloniki Documentary Festival. How people move to the islands or move to the villages, or how the life in the city has changed. We see that a lot. To the Wolf, which went to Berlin now, that would be one of them. It's about life in the villages and how the villagers' lives have changed because they're not able to support their life anymore. And Little Land by Nikos Dagiadas, which is an Arte production. This again is about people moving from the city to an island. People who've studied, who are not villagers, basically city people, trying to make do with whatever they can, you know, outside. And Skapeta could be one of them. Again, it's about a village that has emptied, and there's only one man there, and he won't leave, and he still lives there with his goats.
The documentary festival is now in its 15th year, and Elena Christopoulou, who is coordinating a tribute programme celebrating this history, says it's had a real cultural impact.
It was the first time something like this happened in Greece, in this international scale. It was very difficult in the beginning. It was something new. People weren't accustomed to watching documentaries outside the TV or an educational setting. So it kind of educated people. I don't want to sound arrogant, but the documentary festival had a role in educating audiences to watch documentaries.
As well as soaring unemployment and punishing austerity measures, Greece is experiencing a political turn to the right. One film shown this week, Neo-Nazi, The Holocaust of Memory, traces the rise of the extremist Golden Dawn Party. Dimitri Epides, the director of the festival, say these films provide a different and vital perspective.
A place where alternative information is available was essential, particularly in a city like this at the edge of Europe. We don't have access to such things. Even the young generation had no possibility of knowing what goes on outside the formal channels of information. There's an immediacy in documentaries. There's something else, you know, people that go out with their own camera to express an opinion or a view or to describe a situation. I trust them very much. I respect them also. And I think essential in forming an image of the world, you know, that is really closer to reality.
Having a partner is like Dr. Jekyll suddenly discovering one day what Mr. Hyde's been up to.
Panayotis Evangelides, whose film They Glow in the Dark follows the lives of two friends with HIV in New Orleans, says that the intensely personal approach he takes has meant he's always had to look outside the country for subjects.
They're not ready to take the responsibility of saying that in front of a camera, being themselves. Greece is a rather conservative, deep inside country. We want to enjoy the benefits of the world, but not give much of ourselves.
But this is changing now, as Greece finds itself forced to adapt to difficult new realities.
Μετά τον θάνατο της γυναίκας μου, αισθανόμουν ότι έπρεπε να κάνω ένα άλλο είδος ζωή.
In his film One Step Ahead, Dimitri Athirides followed the mayor of Thessaloniki, Yanis Boutaris, a tattooed former alcoholic businessman and activist who ran for office after he was widowed, during his election campaign 2 years ago. And he sees a parallel in this process of transformation to that of the current national transition.
Every story from Greece now, it has to do with crisis in some way or another. You cannot get one compact story speaking about the crisis. You know, every story has the crisis grinded in it. In the personal story of Yanis Boutaris, I find very interesting his commission and decisiveness to change himself and somehow break this net of bad habits. And yes, you might say that you can view it in a greater analogy to Greek society. There is a very concrete net of bad habits that we have to get through.
In the touching, sometimes troubling crop of documentaries coming out of Greece, filmmakers are trying to reflect not just the effect of the current crisis on the national economy, but also on its identity. From Thessaloniki, for Monocle, I'm Daniela Peled.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. After the news, we'll find out why Swiss German is enjoying a revival, and we'll examine the long list for this year's Orwell Prize for Journalism, and our culture editor Robert Bound will talk us through the latest issue of Monocle magazine, which includes a visit to the recently refurbished Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. But first, with the time just coming up to 30 minutes past the hour, bang on time, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. The president of the Cyprus Chamber of Commerce has today urged political leaders to find a solution to the current impasse for the survival of the country. His comments came as ministers arrived for an emergency cabinet meeting as the government sought solutions to avert a financial meltdown on the island. President Obama has arrived in Israel at the start of his first ever trip to the country. During his three-day visit, he'll hold talks with the Israeli Prime Minister as well as the Palestinian President. As he arrived, over 100 demonstrators erected four large steel-framed tents and a massive Palestinian flag on Israeli-occupied land near Jerusalem. And nearly 24 West and Central African nations have pledged to combat the growing threat of piracy and maritime crime in their coastal waters. The regions border the oil-rich Gulf of Guinea, which is threatening to overtake the waters off Somalia as the world's most dangerous seas for piracy. And here, the British Finance Minister has delivered the country's annual budget statement despite being peppered with catcalls from opposition politicians. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Jonathan will be back at the top of the hour to bring us a full roundup of the world news. In the meantime, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Swiss German, or Schweizerdeutsch, is enjoying a revival, thanks, strangely, to its popularity among young users of new media. Many would have thought this unthinkable a couple of decades ago. To those unacquainted with Schweizerdeutsch, it nods to High German, or Hochdeutsch, with a smattering, well, of anything really, from hyper-local dialects to an almost competitive use of the umlaut, those two little dots you get above some vowels. So, verstehen Sie mich? To tell us more about the impact of this revival, I'm joined on the line from Zurich by Christian Lagernegger, who's a language teacher and entrepreneur. Herzlich willkommen, Christian. Welcome to the programme. Just explain to us, I've tried to explain what Swiss German is, but it's terribly difficult to, because it doesn't really exist as a language in many ways, does it?
Well, the interesting thing with Swiss German is... Swiss German, if you study Middle High German or Old German, that is mostly anyone who speaks Swiss German can read it. Swiss German is an old form of German that hasn't evolved like High German has evolved. So when High German was evolving and they were coming up with rules for how should we write this, how should we pronounce this, Swiss German just kind of stayed like that, like it was 500 years ago.
But you nonetheless also have these hyper-local dialects where the residents of one valley might have difficulty talking to their neighbours 2 miles away.
You do get a lot of regionalisms, which tend to be really mixed into things that are used to describe things like foods or plants and things like that. Like, so regional things, you'll get these, like you said, hyper-regionalisms where it's just like, what's the word for potato that you used? Because that's not the word that we use, and that's completely, or in Appenzell, where I'm from, like, we have different words for different insects and like for butterflies and things like that. So that other places where just they would have no clue about.
Nonetheless, this jumble of lovely, interesting words is, having enjoyed centuries of an oral tradition, is increasingly being enjoyed in its written form. What's that been like?
This has come recently thanks to social media, mostly through things like Twitter, Facebook, but also text messaging, where people, because... Swiss German is the language that is spoken. It's the spoken language. And people tend to write, especially when it comes to quick messages, they will write in the language that they're most familiar with. For Swiss people, that is in Swiss German. So it's becoming, how do I spell that? Well, they'll just be writing their text message and they'll spell it the way that they think it should be spelled. So you have actually a big mix-mash of different spellings of words. So it's a bit like Shakespeare. If you read Shakespeare, he'll spell words differently and use the same word 3 or 4 times, he'll be spelled 3 or 4 different ways. That's what's essentially happening now to Swiss German, with an interesting side note that some spelling forms, even though that there's no official body, people are starting to accept like certain spellings. Like, well, of course we would spell like that. So C, which is the past participle of to be, so being, in High German Gewesen, was now in Swiss German, it's just XE, if you want to spell it, if you want to be with the lingo of how that's spelled in across like text messaging and Facebook and things like that. People will understand XE as C, for the short form, more the Swiss form of Gewesen.
And what kind of effect does that have on Swiss culture, where you have many economic migrants, and you also have schools which speak High German, and then they come equipped with a word like Gewesen, and then they suddenly see C. What effect does that have?
I would say, from my experience teaching expats and other people here in Europe teaching German, it has. It has an alienating effect, which because they, like you said, they come, they've learned High German, they've learned something which has a written form, which has grammatical rules, which you can apply to the language within Switzerland, theoretically, in Germany, in Austria, in Liechtenstein, in Luxembourg. Any German-speaking country will be using these rules, and so they have this. They expect to be able to communicate, and then all of a sudden they're encountered with these text messages and things like that, which can, to a degree, I think a lot of Swiss people, if you're communicating to them in High German through your text messaging, you'll receive High German back. But when you see signage for restaurants and smaller shops, when they start to put this into dialect, it can be alienating, because people will be looking at it and they can't make heads or tails of it.
Christian Langenegger, a language teacher and entrepreneur, thank you very much indeed. Proving that perhaps regardless of what kind of language you use, if a phone line doesn't quite want to play, that's what happens. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back with a first look at the brand new issue of Monocle magazine next.
All this week on Monocle 24, 10 years after the war in Iraq began, we unpick the military campaign and the turbulent aftermath to deliver our verdict on the conflict. Every day, we'll be hearing from the key figures who shaped the action, including the journalists and policymakers who watched from the sidelines and the generals who gave the orders.
When their plan, which was to take over the levers of power and put other hands on those levers, failed, there was no plan B, there was no second course.
The Iraq War, 10 years on, all this week on Monocle 24.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, every day this week, we'll be taking a look at the newest edition of Monocle magazine, which I hold in my hands now. It hits the newsstands worldwide tomorrow. I'm delighted to say our culture editor, Robert Bound, has bounded into the studio to sound the fanfare for the culture section of the magazine. Welcome, Robert.
I was expecting a bugle fanfare.
You are that. Your own bugle fanfare.
Wow. That sounds like a euphemism for something. We must move on.
Tell me about the Rijksmuseum.
The Rijksmuseum was a lovely... It's one of my favourite stories I've ever done, to be able to rock up to a museum a good month before it reopens. It was closed 10 years ago, because, as you said, before we switched the microphones on, it was a bit of a dusty old place.
I remember going there, it must be a million years ago, yeah. And it was one of those museums, those art galleries, that you knew was a national museum because it felt like one. But that didn't necessarily mean it was particularly nice. It had a lot of great stuff in it. but it was almost designed for the art and not for the people who looked at it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly. I think that's fair to say. And it's this big sort of huge Dutch neo-Gothic thing. It's this cathedral to art, or cathedral specifically to one painting, The Night Watch by Rembrandt, which has Pride of Place. And that's the only, they've obviously rehung everything, taken everything down, given everything a clean lick of paint, done some big architectural stuff inside, which I'll talk about in a sec. But as I say, the whole building was essentially built in service to Rembrandt's The Night Watch. That's the only painting of the 8,000 works that hang in the gallery that still is going to hang in the same place when it reopens.
And everything else has moved.
Everything else has changed. They've stripped out a lot of stuff. There's almost 1 million pieces in the collection of the Rijksmuseum, and they're hanging 8,000 pieces in 80 galleries now. So there's 80 galleries to this place. It's huge.
So what does... I remember it being enormous and just massively off-putting. This has all changed, you say?
Yeah, it's been really beautifully done. So I'm gonna wish I'd made notes now as I try to remember. Cruz and Ortiz are the artists. They're Spanish artists based in Seville, who the Rijksmuseum have had redesign some of the exterior, but mostly the interior. The big, what was a public garden in the middle of the museum that you used to ride your bikes through, and it's a sort of proper Dutch, it's an Amsterdam sort of rite of passage and right of way, riding your bicycle through the Rijksmuseum. That's been covered over, and that path has been changed. It's now enclosed in glass. It's kind of like a glass tunnel that goes through the middle of the museum that you ride through. So that's going to be an amazing thing.
What
it's going
fun.
To be a talking point.
Really good fun.
And then the museum is based around what Taku Dibitz, who's the director of collections, who toured me around the museum, and he's got a little picture there.
Let me see.
There he is. He's a very cool guy.
He looks about 20.
No, he's all right. He's all right. Not that being 20 is not all right. He's aged well. I don't know how old he is. Maybe he's probably in his late 30s.
Is he big 40. Enough to do the Rijksmuseum? Clearly, because he's done a beautiful job.
So he's a big guy. He described this courtyard as the lungs of the museum. All the galleries kind of centre around it. All the galleries are around it. So it's beautiful. They've done a wonderful job. And it lives and it breathes and there's a lot more light. And as you can see from the pictures, there are some very different kind of ideas on interior design and paint jobs that they've done as well.
In terms of the way that they have approached the old building, you say there's this wonderful glass tunnel in the middle of the open courtyard. One of the trends for decades now, since Ian Pei put his pyramid in the middle of the Louvre, is to transpose something screamingly modern into very old architecture and see if it works. It worked at the Louvre. It worked at the British Museum. Have they done this at the Rijksmuseum?
They haven't really done that. There's one, the Asian Gallery is a separate building now. And this houses works of art from sort of 5,000. It houses something from 5,000 years BC or whatever. And it's an old Chinese jade thing. And they don't know what it's for, which is rather nice. But anyway, this sits, the oldest artifact sits in this new thing, which sits in a corner of the garden. And you get to it through a corridor in the Rijksmuseum. So that's kind of rather nice. And it's again, designed by Cruz and Ortiz from Spain. And it's a little sympathetic cube that sits in a corner of the garden. So they haven't done this whole kind of mashup of contemporary and Gothic architecture like some museums have.
And at the centre, you said that the Night Watch is there. Did you see it? Had it been rehung?
It was hanging. It was in plastic.
It wasn't leaning against the wall in the corner.
It was just next to where the thing is. So we did manage to get the picture. We had a bit of a wrangle trying to get these pictures into the magazine because
museums don't like to see themselves publicly. They don't like to give away their secrets.
Unlike a maths exam, we're always told in maths exams, always show you're working. That's what we want to see, obviously, as journalists and photographers in the magazine. We're not allowed to show other people's workings, but we managed to wangle it. They were so pleased with the story that they let us break their embargo, in fact, which is why we can talk about it and see it now. But that's the big painting. For readers who have this in their hands or will do tomorrow, if they're subscribers, it's page 172, and there's a lovely picture of where the Night Watch will hang. That's the kind of pregnant space where it will be. And that's the only thing, with a very gilt-looking room, as you can see there. But that's one of the few rooms that's done like that.
There are some fantastic pictures in this, which show the not yet properly dressed Rijksmuseum boxes, which clearly have sculptures in them, and a museum ready to be reopened. You said it was the most exciting thing you'd ever done, going round a museum that hadn't been opened yet. What's it like?
Well, it does have this. It does feel like that space where the Night Watch will hang in the main gallery. Everything has this kind of quality of everything's sort of on pause. You're waiting for the film to restart. Everything has a kind of an air of expectation about it. And there's a genuine atmosphere of, I don't know, there seems to be, everyone is sort of looking forward clearly to the opening with slightly bated breath. There was a lot of work, to be honest, there was a lot of work that needed to be done. I guess there are still diggers and landscape gardeners on the outside and decorators and art experts hanging paintings on the inside. But it really had a wonderful atmosphere of expectation hanging over it.
And finally, at the end of this wonderful article, Robert, you just say, it is Dutch. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's got there is an unshowy quality to the wonderful work that is on display there. What's nice about the Rijksmuseum is that it is, a lot of it is Dutch art, the golden age of Dutch art in the 17th century, Rembrandt, Vermeer, all these wonderful names, and all these wonderful paintings were commissioned and painted 2 miles from the Rijksmuseum in that Nine Streets Canal area of Amsterdam, which was such a hotbed of civilization and of trade and of art. Most of those paintings haven't travelled far to be under the roof of this beautiful building.
Monocle's culture editor Robert Bowne, thank you very much indeed for coming in. Coming up, we'll stay on our cultural theme as we consider this year's Orwell long list. Stay with us. Now, the world of print journalism in the United Kingdom did not enjoy its finest moment last year. The seedy and sometimes illegal methods of working some of the British tabloids were exposed. The whole of the press was intensively scrutinised during the Leveson inquiry. And the end result came this year, then came this week, when the creation of a new regulatory body was announced. It seems there is some work to be done to restore confidence. One event, however, the Orwell Prize, attempts to go some way to do this with its award for good political writing. The long list was announced today, and I'm delighted to say that joining me on the line is Katrina Lewis, who's overseeing the judging process for the prize. Welcome, Katrina. Just to ask you straight away, who is on this long list?
Hello. We have 14 journalists and 12 authors on the long list, so it's a lot of writers on the long list.
No, do carry on. Explain a little bit about the subject matter and the authors who have been selected.
Well, the Orwell Prize is a prize for political writing that aspires to meet Orwell's ambition to make political writing into an art. So we're very pleased to have a range of publications covered. So we have writers from The Times, Financial Times, Guardian. We have a Marie Claire writer this year writing about all sorts of things from the exposing NHS reform and the Starbucks tax issues to the grooming in Rochdale, covering the atrocities in Aleppo, and books take a lot longer, so it's not as immediate, but you've got the wonderful collection of journalism from Mary Colvin, and then you have we have books covering the BNP issues in the UK. And the Spanish Civil War. It's a very widespread set of writing that looks at a lot of issues a lot of great voices.
It is very wide, yet at the same time, there are some very well-trodden paths which are being revisited here. Like, as you mentioned, the Iraq War, we have a study of Baha Moussa's death, a very British killing by A.T. Williams. We also have, is it Bloody Nasty People, The Rise of the Far Right in the United Kingdom. Are there any new subjects in this collection which surprised you?
I think something that we said in judging, and that actually Aretha wrote about today in a column for The Independent, is that in the books list, it does seem like these are all enemies that we know, but it's kind of reaffirming those sort of, it's readdressing the enemies that we know and looking at them again and a call for action to these issues, especially when you look at like Bad Pharma, for example. It's such a campaigning book. In terms of the journalism, there are of course new stories. I think Abigail Howarth writing about women's circumcision is a very, very powerful piece. It's looking at women's rights in Asia. She's particularly excellent at that. And then you've got, you know, the Andrew Norfolk story was such a massive splash last year, as was the Tom Bergen pieces on Starbucks. So, of course, these are new enemies, and there'll be books for them in the future, I'm sure.
And in a world where we are sadly increasingly reliant on very, very short pieces of information flying out very fast. Where do you see the appetite for the investigative book going?
I think the thing about the investigative book is that, I mean, you use the story of the Abu Hazza book for as an example, the Bahimasa book, as an example, and actually that looks at it. I think you'll find you think you know that story, and then you read that book, and actually, it tells you things that you didn't know. It exposes it in a way that you aren't familiar with. The same with the capital punishment, the injustice. You know, you think you know what it's like. You know, you think you understand the whole problem with capital punishment, and then you read that book and you think, hang on a second, this is much more of an issue, which is what I meant by the known enemies being looked at again more closely.
And the Orwell Prize, the winners will be announced, I believe, on the 15th of May, later on this year. Katrina Lewis, for now, thank you very much indeed. That was Katrina Lewis, overseer of the judging for the Orwell Prize. It's time now on Monocle 24 for our daily monologue. Today we turn to Monocle's associate business editor, Adrian Craddock, who gives his rather unconventional opinion on Australians and sport.
When I was younger, I played Australian rules football. I could sell you the story that my wiry frame set me apart as flexible and speedy compared to the other muscly players on the field, but I'd be lying. I remember a rare moment where I was in possession of the ball. Overcome with the novelty of it all, I sprinted forward. In my periphery, I saw two opponents hovering on both sides. They'd caught up with me some time ago, but menacingly had let me continue running. It was at this point I dropped the ball mid-run and bent to pick it up. The next thing I remember was both opponents slamming into my temples. I was the unfortunate meat in a hip and head sandwich. Looking back, the white light that overtook my vision was probably not a result of injury, but the searing feeling of my brain permanently deleting any remaining interest in sport. So when I see the news today that the Australian government is threatening to cut funding to sports by up to 20%, I can't help but think, big deal. Let me share with you a deeply unfashionable opinion. Australians invest way too much in sport, both financially and emotionally. Each year, $100 million of taxpayers' money goes towards Aussie sport. You may say it's money that's well spent on bolstering Australia's international brand. After all, the buff, blonde-haired surfer swanning around Bondi is one of the strongest antipodean clichés. But the pride we feel for being the sporting nation is a deluded one. Statistically, Australia has the fifth highest obesity rate in the world. In reality, Oz is more a country of sports spectators, and our boundless adulation has come at the cost of celebrating more worthy exports. By pure osmosis, I can probably tell you more about Ian Thorpe than I can about any of the faces on our national currency. Here's a simple example. Let me tell you the names of two Australian people, and see which one you recognise. Shane Warne and Howard Walter Florey. The first, obviously, is one of the world's best spin bowlers. The second, a Nobel laureate who pioneered the use of penicillin in medicine. One is venerated as a national hero, the other is barely a blip on the national psyche. So, to the Australians who are obsessing about the country's recent dip in sporting prowess, about allegations of bullying and drug abuse amongst our celebrated game players, perhaps avert your attention to Indigenous unemployment, the dwindling health of the Great Barrier Reef, or something else that actually matters. Then again, what do I know? My head's never been the same since that nasty concussion. For Monocle, I'm Adrian Craddock.
And that's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer Hannah Jenkins, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Edward Lucas, and our studio manager Chris Fitch. Up next is The Entrepreneurs, where Sophie Grove will be pulling on her Wellington boots to discover the businesses making use of the great outdoors, including a report on the growing importance of land rights in the West Bank.
Because the Israeli occupation has forced development to be within the major Palestinian cities, land prices within these cities has skyrocketed to the point where it's become unaffordable for the majority of Palestinians. 1,000 square meters, quarter of an acre, is worth anywhere between $800,000 to $1 million US dollars.
That's all coming up after the news, and in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and myself will be back in the chair to bring you the Monocle Daily. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.